I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is broadcaster, author, and publisher Tavis Smiley.
Good evening. I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of 91.7 KALW Public Radio. Thank you. And on behalf of the JCCSF, I want to welcome you to an evening with Tavis Smiley. At KALW, we have carried Tavis's radio programs ever since he first came to public radio when he launched the Tavis Smiley Show in 2002. And we continue to broadcast his current show, to the Tavis Smiley Show, Fridays at noon. And he's also now a staple of public television. His interview show, Tavis Smiley, is carried by PBS stations across the country. And he had quite a career before he came to public media. He was an aide to Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, a host on BET, and a regular commentator on Tom Joyner's nationally syndicated radio show. And I will say, from listening to Tavis and getting to know him a little bit at various moments over the years, he has a really powerful voice and perspective that is rare in journalism and in broadcasting, and he's used it to draw attention to the blight of widespread poverty in this country, the history of the civil rights movement and its unfulfilled promise, and to the compromises and hypocrisies of leaders of all kinds of political persuasions. But in addition, he has always lifted up other brilliant voices. I think of legal scholar Kim Crenshaw, civil rights advocate Connie Rice, both of whom are regular commentators on his radio show, and of course, Dr. Cornel West, with whom he co-hosted the show Smiley and West for a few years. That was a great radio show, I gotta say. And he also is someone who is just in touch with really remarkable creative people. Recently, we got to broadcast on the sad occasion of Prince's death, Tavis's interviews with Prince, which were very unusual for broadcast media in their depth and the connection that they had with one another. Tavis is the author of more than a dozen books, including The Rich and the Rest of Us, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year, My Journey with Maya, and his autobiography, What I Know for Sure, My Story, Growing Up in America. His new book, Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days, which tells the story of the final months of Michael Jackson's life, is just out. And I can tell you that Tavis can describe it a lot better than I can, so I want to have you welcome him here to the stage here at the JCCSF.
Wow, good evening, good evening. Wow. Thank you. Let me start by thanking Matt for such a generous and kind introduction. That might, Matt, be the second best introduction I've ever received. And I only say second best because I was in Chicago the other day and the person to introduce me didn't show up and I did it myself. Other than that, it was awfully gracious and kind, and I thank you. Let me seriously thank Matt and his wonderful team at KALW for carrying our work, our witness, week in and week out, night in and night out. I am so humbled by the opportunities that I've been blessed to have being a part of the public radio and public television family. One of my favorite films is a movie that I'm sure many of you have seen called Broadcast News, starring a great actor, William Hurt. There's a line in that movie where William Hurt's character asks the question, what do you do when your life exceeds your dreams? What do you do when your life exceeds your dreams? And in so many ways, as we'll talk about tonight, I suspect, my life has exceeded my dreams. And I was just sharing with someone earlier today that when I first came on the airwaves of public radio, it was met with a great deal of resistance. Resistance for really simple things that were kind of funny to me. I talk too fast. I talk too loud. I saved one letter that came to NPR complaining that my laugh was too boisterous, which I just got a kick out of. But I didn't have that typical, this is National Public Radio. I didn't have that nice sound, I suspect. And so for a while, the listening audience didn't quite gel with my style, with my brand. And over time, that changed, and I've had a remarkable run now for almost 15 years, I think, on public radio. And then a few years after that, we added the television program. So to KALW and all those stations around the country that took a chance on us so many years ago, and most importantly to all of you who listen and watch, thank you, San Francisco, for having me here tonight and for being so supportive. I appreciate it. But let me just say a few brief words about this particular book. It's been interesting to me to hear people suggest to me, and I get it, that they think that this book is a bit out of my wheelhouse. You know, I think people were like, Tavis Smiley, Michael Jackson. They didn't quite get that, and I understand that. Because of all the books I've written, this one is the one that is probably the outlier, if you will, of the other texts that I have written about issues and other individuals, like, as you heard Matt say, Martin and Maya. This was the last book in this is the last book in a 3-book deal that I did with Little Brown. I'd never worked with them before. They've been wonderful publishers to work with. But I did a 3-book deal with them, knowing when I went into it that I only had one idea at the time, and that was the King book, the book about Dr. King's last year. It is the story. The book is called Death of a King, as you heard Matt say earlier, and I'm happy to announce. It was announced a year ago, but we're about to make a big announcement in just a few weeks. So J.J. Abrams of Star Wars fame and I are producing a movie based on that book, and there'll be more, a big announcement about that in probably just 3 or 4 weeks from now. So I'm excited about the fact we get a chance to bring that story of King's final year to a broader audience, courtesy of my collaboration with J.J. Abrams and with Warner Brothers. But that the story of Dr. King's last year is the story of a man who has changed considerably since 1963 in the March on Washington. I know that many of you think that Dr. King only gave one speech in his whole life. And some of y'all even think the speech only had one line in it. That I want my children to live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I ain't going to ask you to go any further. I know that's all you know from that speech. And it is the case that we loop that speech, we loop that paragraph over, that sentence, as it were. We loop that over and over and over again as if that's the only speech that Martin ever gave and the only line in that particular speech, which is not the case, and I won't belabor the point. But King was on the road all the time. And we freeze frame him in 1963 in that speech, I Have a Dream, at the March on Washington, so that we don't really understand how he had changed by the time he got to the last year in his life. And the book tells the story, Death of a King. The text tells the story literally of the last year in King's life. From April 4, 1967, literally 1 year to the day later, April 4, 1968. In 67, April 4, Martin gives the most controversial speech of his entire life. That speech is called Beyond Vietnam at Riverside Church in Manhattan, where he calls America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. So Martin's words, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, and then goes on to tell America that if you don't get serious about what he called the triple threat facing our democracy, America was in trouble. Martin's triple threat, as you know, racism, poverty, and militarism. Racism, poverty, and militarism. That was Martin in 1967. Sound familiar? Yes. Racism, poverty, and militarism. For giving that speech, the cosmos, the very next day, April 5, 1967, turned against Dr. King. And the story of King's last year that we don't know is that once he gave that speech, this Nobel laureate, the youngest until Malala, received it just a year or so ago, Nobel laureate on the list of the most admired Americans. Overnight, all of that changed. The next day, Martin woke up and every major newspaper in this country ripped him to shreds. And I say all the time that there was no Fox News channel around at the time, But can you imagine what Fox News would have done? Bill and Megan and Sean and Greta, what they would have done to him the minute he uttered that America was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world at the height of a war. But we didn't need Fox News then because the liberal media did the Fox News job for them. The Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, it's embarrassing now to read what these liberal institutions said about Martin the very next day. They ask whether or not, this is in print, they ask or suggested that Martin had outlived his usefulness. That's a phrase. That he had outlived his usefulness, that he had become a burden to his people, that he was a distraction, that he had lost his way. And of course, they were making Martin pay a heavy price because essentially they had given this Negro license to stay in this lane of civil rights. But ain't nobody told you you had no right to talk about foreign policy. That is not your lane. And you don't tell us how to set our priorities as a government. Martin was saying then, still relevant today, these are his words, that budgets are moral documents. Budgets are moral documents. If I can quote that great philosopher, Jay-Z, you can say what you say, but you are who you are. And when you put your budget on the table, we get to see who you really are. And Martin was saying, Mr. President, you promised a war on poverty, but now you engage in a war in Vietnam. And the resources that should be applied here are now being wasted over here. The bombs that are dropping over there are landing in the ghettos and barrios of America's cities. Budgets are moral documents. And because Martin was bold enough to tell a truth that at the time was too subversive for us to handle, they turned on Martin. In the last year of his life, from April 4, 67 to April 4, 68, he was disinvited to the White House. He was disinvited to preach in black churches. He could not get a paid speech. He'd been shopping another book. He'd been a best-selling author. They wouldn't give him a book deal. The media turns on him. First, the mainstream media, and then, sadly, the black media turned on him. Karl Rowan, the black commentator of that era, turned on him publicly. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. turned on him publicly. Thurgood Marshall turned on him publicly. The NAACP and Roy Wilkins turned on him publicly. Whitney Young and the Urban League turned on him publicly. He was toxic. He was persona non grata. The last poll taken in his life found that 75% of the American people thought he was irrelevant. Three quarters of the American people. Almost 60% of black folk thought he was irrelevant. Martin dies broke, and his dear friend Harry Belafonte had to pay for his funeral. That is the story of the last year of Martin's life that most of us just don't know. And so I wrote that book to share the story of Martin, because if you think you know Martin because you've frozen him in the frame of 63, but you don't know him in the last year of his life, then you don't know Martin. Because the truth is, and you know this, that we come to know who we really are as human beings. We come to know who we really are in the deep, dark, desolate hours of our life. That's when you discover who you really are. And can I add to that? You discover who your friends really are in those deep, dark, desolate hours. So if you think you know Martin in 63, but you don't know his journey the last mile of the way, so to speak, then you don't know Martin. In 63, he's talking about integration. In the last year of his life, Martin is saying in this book, Death of a King, that for all the work we've done, I fear that we have integrated into a burning house. In 63, he's talking about we shall overcome. In 67, he's saying that the dream he had become a nightmare. And the last call that Martin makes from the Lorraine Motel in Memphis back to his church to talk to his father, his co-pastor, Daddy King, and his secretary and his mother, he shared with them what his sermon was going to be on Sunday morning. He called them on a Thursday. He was assassinated on a Thursday night in Memphis. He called in every Thursday or Friday what his sermon was going to be so they had time to type it up into the bulletin to pass out to you Sunday morning when you walked in for service. You get that Sunday morning program. So he had to call his sermon in a few days ahead of time. And the sermon that Martin was going to preach, had he made it back to Atlanta on that Sunday, was going to be entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. Why America May. He didn't consign America to hell. He didn't condemn America to hell. But that was the sermon, Why America May Go to Hell. And his thesis was going to be what I suggested earlier, that if we don't get serious about that triple threat of racism and poverty and militarism, America may just be sliding into hell. So for all the hell that Martin was catching in that last year, this Negro still had enough courage and enough conviction and enough commitment and enough character to tell the truth anyway, even though folk couldn't handle it. Fast forward almost 50 years later, this Negro's name is on every street. I was on it today. Every street, every school, every library, postage stamp, monument in Washington, holiday. Now Martin is all that and then some, but that is not what he saw. That is not what he felt when we took his life. We abandoned him. We isolated him. And then we assassinated him. It's only all these years later that we've really come to terms with who Martin really was and the truth he was telling. And yet, I believe that we're still honoring him on the cheap. Because all of those accolades he deserves, and it's a beautiful thing, but pardon my English, we ain't yet come to terms with the racism, the poverty, and the militarism. And that's why that story, I think, is so relevant now. So I wrote that book first in this three-book deal with Little Brown. I didn't know that all three of them would be M's. We call them the three M's, Martin, Maya, and Michael. The Maya book tells of my 28-year friendship with Maya. I was just a kid when I met her. And I get goosebumps when I think about it. But I was trying to figure out who I was and I was trying to find my own voice and what my role in the world really was. And I was a bit lost. And somehow I got invited to go on a trip to Africa with Maya Angelou. I had never left the country. I certainly hadn't been to Africa. But when you're a 20-year-old kid and you get invited to go to Africa with Maya Angelou and your only job is to carry her bags, you take the assignment. And I went to Africa with Maya, and I won't waste your time tonight telling you the whole story, but that trip to Africa, Maya never treated me like the handler that I was. But she shared with me, she poured into me, she asked my view and my opinion, and that started a 28-year friendship. And it is the most humbling thing. I said earlier, sometimes your life exceeds your dreams. I again, still get goosebumps when I think about how just a few years after that, I had found my voice, and the great Maya Angelou started appearing many times as a guest on my TV program, on my radio program. So she got to see my development come full circle. And so this book, My Journey with Maya, tells the 28-year friendship that we had. And I miss her even to this day so very dearly. So that was the second book, Martin, Maya. And this is the third, Michael. Now, I had no idea I was going to write a book about Michael. And the story is simply this. I'm from Indiana. Grew up in Indiana. Michael Jackson is from Indiana. I was a Michael Jackson fan growing up in Indiana. Woke up every Saturday morning to watch the Jackson 5 cartoon on Saturday mornings. So I was a big fan of Michael growing up. So Michael's music, of course, becomes the soundtrack of my life and many of your lives. Michael's music is on the soundtrack to our lives. I think, though, that sometimes we get so caught up in people's, this is true of Martin as well, we get so caught up sometimes in the iconography that we lose sight of the humanity. The iconography obscures our view of their humanity. And let me just say out front, so I don't lose you in this talk tonight, that I am the first to admit to you that Michael had flaws. He had self-inflicted wounds. He made bad choices, bad decisions. To my mind, that just makes him human. I wrote a book some time ago, and there's a chapter in the book that was entitled, Some of Us is Not the Sum of Us. The S-O-M-E of us is not the S-U-M of us. I can't speak for you, but I suspect I'm right when I suggest that you don't want your life to be judged by the S-O-M-E. I know I certainly don't. I done made a whole bunch of mistakes, and I don't want nobody to judge my life by the S-O-M-E, because the S-O-M-E that you might pick out, the S-O-M-E that you might choose is not going to show me in my best light. So I don't want to be judged by the S-O-M-E. I want to be judged by the S-U-M, the sum total of my life and legacy, the sum total of my work and witness, the S-U-M, not the S-O-M-E. And sometimes when it comes to these iconic figures, we look at the S-O-M-E, lose sight of the S-U-M. We see the iconography. We lose sight of their humanity. And I was able to bring Martin's humanity. We see him as such an icon all these years later. That last year of his life was getting at his humanity.
You're listening to broadcaster, author, and publisher Tavis Smiley, whose new book is Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so the same treatment has been applied to the Michael Jackson book. With Martin, it's the last year of his life. With Michael, it's the last 16 weeks of his life. This book starts, the entry point here is his announcing in London that he's coming back one more time for this concert series called This Is It. Coming back one more time, This Is It. He makes the announcement. When he makes the announcement, I decide immediately, if this is going to be it in the O2 in London, I want to go see it. And I knew that everybody was going to be calling Michael, trying to get tickets. So being as smart as I am, I didn't call Michael. I called his mama. I put my Indiana roots and my Indiana relationship with the Jackson family, called his mother and said, Miss Catherine, how much do you love me? How long we've been friends? Have I ever asked you for anything? And I'm laying it on her, and she just says, how many tickets do you want, Tavis? I said, just two. And so once I was assured that my tickets were going to be taken care of, I told my assistant, get my plane tickets, get my hotel reservations. I'm going to be there. I want to go to London to see this show. So I'm preparing to go to London. 16 weeks later, Michael draws his last breath. And as a fan, I am gobsmacked that at 50 years of age, Michael Jackson is dead. As a fan, not as a broadcaster, as a media personality, as a journalist or whatever, just as a fan, I want to know what happened. I started this book with one central question. Why are you gone so soon? When I got into the research, my question did a 180 on me. It was no longer why are you gone so soon, but rather, how did you survive this long? When I saw all that was going on in his world and how he was trying to navigate this tension between his drug dependency on the one hand and his dogged desire, his deep determination to stage the biggest comeback of his career. How do you square those two things? Michael is taking propofol at night, Demerol shots by day. There's no way anybody can survive that cocktail for too long. Propofol at night and Demerol by day. So he's self-medicating and still determined to get back on the stage. There is a tape. If you go online, you can find it. You have to link, but it's out there. If you link enough, you'll get to it. They played this tape during the Conrad Murray trial when the state went after him for wrongful death, for manslaughter. for whatever reason, on one particular night, Conrad Murray, the doctor, recorded a conversation on his cell phone with Michael Jackson. And Michael is clearly under the propofol. He is slurring his words. He's only half lucid. But there are two things about that phone call recorded, and I try with my collaborator David Rich to tell the story in the book in a way that I hope you will find is haunting when you read it, as we tried to. It's haunting when you read it as it felt for me when I heard the tape, because it was arresting to my spirit to hear Michael on this tape. Now again, he's under propofol, so he's only half lucid, only half conscious. But there are two things that come out in that tape. One is, at the age of 50, all these years later, Michael is still tormented by his childhood. The childhood that he didn't have, the abuse of that childhood, he's tormented by this. And you can't tell me that when you have conscious, when you're not even alert, when you're not even lucid, you're slurring your words, you're barely audible or understandable in certain parts. When that stuff comes out under that altered state of consciousness, it's deep inside of you. But it comes out on this tape, just talking out of his head. Second thing that comes out on that tape is that he is saying to Conrad Murray, "I've got to get back on the stage. I miss my fans. I miss doing what I do. I've got to get back on the stage, and I want it to be the biggest and the baddest and the best show for my fans that I've ever done." So again, he's wrestling with this tension of what his childhood or lack thereof has done to him and made of him, but wanting to get back on the stage for his fans. When I heard that tape, it unsettled me. It was unhousing for me to hear Michael in this altered state of consciousness and to see how deep that was in his DNA, in his spirit, and in his soul. So that Michael makes this announcement, "I'm coming back one more time." I think everybody in this room, no doubt, has seen, I know I've watched it 1,000 times, the This Is It documentary. And whatever you think of Michael Jackson, you can't but be impressed when you saw those rehearsals. And when you got a chance to see the way he worked his magic and how his genius was in play in those rehearsals. And on that last rehearsal, he just slayed that thing. And Kenny Ortega, the director, who had weeks earlier, said to AEG, "Michael cannot do this. I just don't know that he can do it." He gave a warning to the promotion company. But by the time Michael, weeks later, had worked through those issues, and on that last night of his rehearsal, Kenny Ortega sends a note to the promoters. He's ready. He's ready to go now. This show is going to be magical. And Michael essentially goes home and dies. So there's something, I love human drama. I love the story of how people put everything they have on the line to try to accomplish a certain feat, a certain task. And I know I've been there before in my own life. I know the work, the drama, the effort, the energy that it takes to try to get to a particular place in your life where you feel you belong. I can't imagine what it must be like to try to get back to center stage, the only place you're comfortable, to do the thing that you were born to do. Again, there's a parallel to King in the sense that Martin was so reviled after having been so revered. In the last year of his life, he is so reviled. And Martin is doing it for all the right reasons, and we can debate what Michael's reasons were. We'll get to that. But Martin was organizing in the last year of his life, as you know, his Poor People's Campaign. And he was hopeful that by focusing on the poor, that all this hell that he had caught about the Vietnam War, he wasn't going to stop telling his truth. But he was trying to expand his message and focus and put a spotlight on the poor in this country, on poverty, on income inequality, on economic immobility. And so for his staff, at least, they saw that as a way to get Martin back where he belonged and get all this heat off of him from the Vietnam War. They can't raise money. His organization is bankrupt. This, at least, is a focus, an extension of the work that we have been doing. But they wanted him to do anything to get off of that Vietnam thing that he was on. Now, Martin, again, talked about racism, poverty, and militarism, so he wasn't backing down. But just the idea of watching Martin in this last year and the research try to get back to what they at least saw as center for him. I come back to Michael Jackson. This guy is struggling, trying to get back to where he belongs. The read on Michael, the contemporary read, is that he was desperate. He needed money. He had debt. That's all true. But I also argue that Michael died from greed as much as he died from bad choices. When he announces the concert series, it's supposed to be initially 10 shows. And the greed of corporate America pushed that thing from 10 shows to 20 shows to 30 shows to 40 shows to 50 shows. And everybody knew Michael couldn't do no 50 shows. But they put their hooks into you. And they want to extract every ounce that they can out of you because everybody wants to get paid off of Michael Jackson. That's why his mother sued the promoter for wrongful death. Because she knew that they knew or felt that they knew his condition. But they went and pushed anyway to extract everything out of him. Now, is Michael responsible? Of course he's partly responsible. Nobody makes Michael Jackson sign a contract. He knew what he was doing. But that combination of desperation and greed is in part, I think, what killed him. And so these last 16 weeks, when I dig into it, are just fraught with so much drama. He's got creditors coming after him. He's got lawsuits everywhere. He's so non-confrontational in the last 16 weeks, and that's why these shows ballooned to 50, because he ain't got the ability to say no to anybody. In a 16-week period of time, Michael has 5 different managers. On one day, which is kind of funny to me, on one day in the last 16 weeks, 3 different press releases were put out by 3 different managers, all claiming to represent Michael Jackson. On one day, 3 different press releases on the same day, because Michael didn't want to deal with it. So he was like hiring one manager to fire another manager. His daddy is outside his gate at his house ringing the doorbell, begging Michael to let him come inside. And Michael don't want to deal with it because he knows his daddy's coming in to pressure him to cancel the concerts in London and to do a reunion tour with his brothers. His argument is that if you do a reunion tour, one, you're going to make a lot more money, and two, you ain't got to do as many shows. So he's squeezing Michael. He wants to be Michael's manager again, and they want to do this reunion concert with his brothers. So he's feeling family pressure. He's feeling corporate pressure. He's got creditors coming at him. He's got former employees who are suing him. He can't shut it off at night. It's a funny story in the book. I think it's funny. It's a bit, there's some morbidity to it perhaps, but I just think it's funny because I know both. I knew Prince so well. But there's one night Michael wants to go to sleep, and he tells somebody, "I want to go to sleep, but don't let me sleep too long." He says, "I'm afraid if I sleep too long, God's going to give all the good ideas to Prince." So I don't want to sleep too long. But the point is that he couldn't shut it off. And as you heard from the trial, Michael would ask at night for his milk. He called propofol milk. He wanted his milk before he went to bed. I've been asked many times about Conrad Murray and whether or not he actually cared about Michael, whether he killed Michael, whether he was just in it for the money. I don't know, because I can't speak for Conrad Murray. What I know is that when you get into a space with a figure as iconic as Michael Jackson, it is hard for anybody to say no. Barry Gordy of Motown fame told me that one of Michael's problems was, as much as he loved Michael, Michael got to a point in his life where he was rudderless. And when you are rudderless, when you are not anchored and you become unmoored, you start to drift. Anything can happen. We used to sing a song in my little church. I grew up in a little small Pentecostal church, a little holiness church back in Indiana. And we used to sing a song, and the words were, "There's a storm out on the ocean, and it's moving this away. If your soul is not anchored in Jesus, you will surely drift away." Now, take the Jesus out if you're atheist, agnostic, or something else, and God bless you for that. take the Jesus out. You take my point. If your soul isn't anchored to something, then you start to drift. And Barry Gordy's assessment was that Michael had become rudderless. There are many people in Michael's circle who felt that things started to turn the wrong way for him when he distanced himself from Q, from Quincy Jones. Q, not just a great musical genius, and his own artistic impression is on Off the Wall and on Thriller, but was a father figure to Michael in some ways, and many people were concerned that when he basically cut Q off, that that had an impact on the decisions and the process he was making. But it is the case that sometimes we get to a point in our lives where we only take our own counsel. We can't listen or hear anybody else. I've been asked many times, what about the folk in his inner circle? Couldn't they help him? What about his family? When you have a family, and I say this lovingly, who is always asking, I've got 9 brothers and sisters, and I'm the oldest. I've got 31 nieces and nephews, and they all love me, but I know something about people asking you for stuff all the time. And so it's an interesting, complex situation, not unlike anybody else's family, yours included. Families are complex. As somebody said many years ago, you can choose your friends, but you ain't got no say-so in your family. You got to deal with them. But there are all kinds of pressures and expectations and demands, and Michael was feeling that pressure, and at night he could not shut it off. He couldn't shut his brain down. The most difficult part I had in writing this book was trying to, I believe that if you're going to write a book, you have to be empathetic to the character. Not sympathetic, empathetic. You got to put yourself in their shoes to the best of your ability. And the part I had the most difficult time with was trying to put myself in a position of empathy to understand why Michael needed that propofol every night. I've never used drugs in my life. I've never drank. I've never smoked. I got vices, but that ain't it. And don't ask me what they are. but drinking and drugging are not my vices. So I couldn't quite get there. And then in the writing of this book, I couldn't sleep. And that happens every now and then. I'm tired. You ever been so tired you can't go to sleep? Sometimes it happens. There's so much on my mind. Or I'm in a different hotel, you know, and just can't shut it down. Or it's already so late, and I got to be up in 3 or 4 hours to start doing media again on book tour. No sense in going to sleep because I don't want to get up, and I'll be mad when I got to wake up in 3 hours. So you wrestle with these things. But one night I was at my house in L.A. and in the midst of writing this book, and I couldn't sleep, and I got up to go to the cabinet to get me 2 Advil PM. And it hit me. There I am. I couldn't sleep. I needed some help. And I tried to multiply that 1,000 times with all that he had going on, all the pressure he's under. You got to deliver. You got a rehearsal. We need this money. We got you under contract to us. The creditors, the lawsuits, the media talking about you, yada, yada, yada. I'm trying to, in that moment, it hit me. Now, it's no excuse for what Michael did, but it was my way in to try to at least understand and empathize with the situation he was in. I think part of what troubles me most is that, again, people think that it was desperation for money or his own personal greed, and not just that of corporate America. But in truth, more than any other thing, more than any other reason, Michael wanted to get back on stage because he knew he was getting older, and his children had never seen him perform live. Now, talk about a human story. What parent wouldn't do anything for their child? Michael's children had only seen him perform on tape. They had never seen him perform live. He decided that if he was ever going to do it, he had to do it now. He was 50. And his shows are so full of high energy, as you know, that, again, there's no guarantee. I'm going to be honest with you. I told Mrs. Jackson I wanted my tickets for night one. Not because of my ego, because I knew them shows were going to get canceled. Because he couldn't do 50 shows. And so before you start canceling shows, I want to see you. So night one, night two, but early on, I want to get in before the cancellations begin. But for his children, he wanted to get back on stage one more time. In this book, in the journey of the last 16 weeks, you'll see a lot of stuff that I've just told, a lot more stuff that I haven't talked about. But at the end of the day, it is what we call a historical novel, which is to say it reads like a novel, but all the stuff is based on fact. At the back of the book, you see all the sources that I cite for where I got all my information, so everything is there. Somebody asked me today, is it a sympathetic treatise? I said, no, it's not sympathetic. As I said earlier, I think we get so caught up in the iconography that we lose sight of the humanity. And everybody is somebody's child. Everybody's somebody's kid. We all make mistakes. And I just want us to look at him through a different lens. And all I'm trying to see is what that last 16 weeks were like. Let the chips fall where they may. We don't cover up the mistakes and the bad choices he made, but this is the journey of the last 16 weeks. When I say that everybody's somebody's child and everybody's somebody's kid and we got to find our way into their humanity, that came home for me after Michael was dead But I got a call from his mother one day. Miss Catherine called me. I had curated an exhibit, had been involved in an exhibit that traveled the country for 4 years, the first of its kind, that looked at black history. 300 artifacts, 300 rare artifacts that told the story of the black contribution to America over a 500-year period. The exhibit was called America, I Am, the African American Imprint. Again, it traveled the country to big cities for 4 years. And one of the stops was in Los Angeles at our museum there, one of our museums. And Mrs. Jackson called me and said, "Tabitha, I want to come see this exhibit. And I'm wondering if you can arrange that." I said, "Mrs. Jackson, of course. I'll be happy to come myself and give you a personal tour and show you around." And she says, "But I want to bring Michael's kids." I said, "Oh, that's a little different." So I knew the paparazzi would be everywhere when they saw them out and about in L.A. TMZ would be all up in my face. And in the kids' faces. And so I called the museum director and said, "Mrs. Jackson and Michael's kids want to come see the exhibit, and I need to make sure you guys shut it down on this particular date. When it closes, just know that we're going to stay open for a few extra hours that night, because I'm going to come when the museum is empty and give a private tour of the exhibit to Mrs. Jackson and Michael's kids."
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features broadcaster, author, and publisher Tavis Smiley, whose new book is Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
All the arrangements were made. I showed up. I'm standing on the curb waiting for them to pull up. The entourage pulls up. Mrs. Jackson gets out. All the kids jump out, and we say hello. I'd never met them, so I met them for the first time that day. And I give them a tour of the exhibit. It just so happened that in the exhibit of black history, just so happened that Michael's image appeared in three different places in this 30, 40,000 foot square foot exhibition, massive exhibit. But Michael's image appeared three or four times throughout the exhibit. And the first time, Mrs. Jackson, as I'm walking through, giving the tour and doing my lecture and all this, first time she saw Michael's image, she broke down crying. And I had to stop, and we just had to sit for a minute and let her get herself together. And I went on. Second time she saw Michael's photo, she broke down again. We stopped again, gave her a moment. Third time she saw Michael's image, the last time, she broke down again. Had to give her a minute. It hit me in that moment that everybody is somebody's child. And everybody's somebody's kid. And none of us wants to be judged by the SOME, but by the SUM. When I was on tour last week for this book in New York City, and these allegations came out again about Michael Jackson, what they allegedly found at his house. I've been asked about that 1,000 times, so let me answer that now before you ask. One, those allegations that came out last week are not new. Number two, whatever they allegedly found in Michael's house, the jury saw that information during the trial. Number three, after seeing whatever the jury saw, they still voted to acquit Michael Jackson. You can like that or loathe it. You can agree or disagree. And as Americans, as human beings, we are entitled to our own opinion. But we have a system of jurisprudence. And Michael went in that system, and he was acquitted. Number four, Michael's fans didn't trust the DA, Tom Snedden, then. He was clearly on a vendetta. He went after Michael two or three times. So Michael's fans didn't trust Tom Snedden or his investigators then. And there's no reason to believe they're going to trust them now. This information comes from the same source now that it came from a dozen years ago. If you think Michael did it 12 years ago, you still think Michael did it. If you think he didn't do it, you still think he didn't do it. So I don't think anybody's mind, honestly, has been changed by these new allegations. But you will never convince me, having said all of that, that this stuff just magically, mysteriously, or coincidentally came out on the anniversary of his assassination. And you got to be stuck on stupid to believe that. strings are being pulled, and somebody wanted this stuff released around the time of his anniversary. It just is not just coincidental that it just came out. In the final analysis, it appears to me that Michael Jackson didn't live in peace. He didn't die in peace. And apparently, they ain't going to let him rest in peace. Now, can you kill a dead man? Sure you can. You can kill a dead man. Because a dead man doesn't have any agency to come back from the grave, any ability to come back and speak for himself or for herself. But the greater tragedy for me, because this is not just about Michael Jackson, child molestation, child endangerment is illegal. It is against the law. It is immoral. It is unethical. It is unprincipled. It's every unthing you can think of, unacceptable, no matter who does it. I was not there. I would never know. You were not there. You would never know. But here's what we do know. We don't know what happened, but we do know this, that there are people in this country, celebrities, who are accused of having done the same thing Michael Jackson did. And they still work in Hollywood. And they are celebrated in Hollywood. And other stars want to work on their films in Hollywood, accused of having done the same thing. There are other folk in Hollywood who were accused of doing the same thing who ran away to another country. And for better than 50 years, they won't come back to stand trial in our system of jurisprudence. What's your point, Tavis? I'm glad you asked. My point is simply this, that America has a funny way of deciding who it wants to denigrate and who it wants to celebrate. We have a funny way of deciding who we're going to lift up, who we're going to push down. That is at best inconsistent. At worst, it is hypocritical. And that's not about Michael Jackson. It's about what we really feel about this issue. If we really, really feel that way about this issue, why do we demonize some people and lionize other people? That inconsistency is something I don't quite get. So just tell me what the rules are. Tell me what rules we're playing by, and I can roll with it, but I need to know what the rules are. The reason why we called this book Before You Judge Me is that in one of Michael's songs, lesser known, lesser celebrated, a song called Childhood, he writes these lyrics. Before you judge me, try hard to love me. Before you judge me, try hard to love me. And as I studied all of Michael's lyrics, that one jumped out at me because as I heard Matt in his very generous introduction suggest earlier, I'm always trying to get at the humanity of people. If you watch my TV show or listen to my radio show, I hope that what comes through every night is that I am not trying to impress you with my intellect. I'm not trying to impress you with what I know. I don't believe in cutting people off when they're trying to talk so you can hear my voice. I want to give people a space to express themselves. What I'm trying to get at, I want to revel in your humanity. I want to celebrate your dignity. This is your platform to be heard. And I want to open a door to make you feel comfortable to express yourself in any way you want, no matter who you are, no matter what you're on to promote or talk about. I just love celebrating people's dignity and their humanity and their gift. That's what my role is about, to open up the doors to allow you to experience that. And in so doing, allow you to have your assumptions examined. In doing that, to help you expand your inventory of ideas, and doing that, to introduce Americans to each other and allow you to see the world through a different prism. But that all happens because what I'm trying to get at is your humanity. I want to know who you fundamentally are. And so that notion of that lyric, before you judge me, try hard to love me, is a beautiful mantra, I think, for all of us. How different the world would be if that were each and every one of our, if that was the edict for each of our lives. That before we judge folk, we're going to first try hard to love them. And I think everybody is worthy of that. Again, people don't want your sympathy, but everybody deserves your empathy. And so that lyric particularly, especially struck me as what should be the title for the particular book. Finally, I've talked to so many people about Michael over the years, and then certainly in the researching and writing of this of this text, but there is a particular story that I've not written about or told publicly, not broadly at least. I talked about it earlier today somewhere, I think briefly, maybe been off the air, I don't recall. But I was friends with Prince for 20 years, as many of you know. We put all of our, as might say, we put our some of our interviews out when he died. We put those interviews out, so I wanted people to, again, have a different way into his humanity. Because here again, everybody's looking at his iconography. They can't get to his humanity. They don't know who he really is. He's not here to explain himself. And how ironic is it? Michael and Prince, both born the same year, both dead in their 50s, both dead from drug dependency, neither ever recreational users, started using drugs to anesthetize pain, and they were anesthetizing that pain because what they really wanted to do was to continue getting on the stage to love and serve us. How ironic, they're both dead in the same way in their 50s. When word came that Michael Jackson had died, Prince was in his studio at Paisley Park rehearsing to headline the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. Prince canceled rehearsals, sent all the band members home, and for days, and I mean days, locked himself in his room and wouldn't come out. Prince, I believe, as many of us do when we lose friends or colleagues who we are somehow connected to, I think Prince started wrestling with that dance with mortality that one day he would have to do, because nobody could believe that Michael was dead at 50. So Prince just shut it down. Days later, he came out, and we talked on the phone, and we were talking about his headlining Montreux, and he asked me if I would come. I said, sure. I'd seen Prince 1,000 times. We traveled the world together. But I got a ticket, and I went to Montreux to be there with Prince. He killed the show. We just slayed it. Just amazing concert in Montreux. And then after the concert that night, we went to a little after party, hung out for a little bit. About 1:30 or 2 o'clock, we're at his hotel. He's in the presidential suite. Where else would Prince be? Presidential suite. On the top floor of this hotel, and I recall these French doors that opened out to the top, to the balcony, I mean to the roof of the hotel. And we walked out there and we sat. So we're in Montreux, Swiss Alps, the mountains all around us. And we sat there from about 2 o'clock in the morning until the sun came up. And I did all the listening and Prince did all the talking about Michael Jackson. And to sit and to listen to one icon, one artistic genius, talk about his respect and reverence for the gift of another was a moment that I'll never forget, to sit and listen to his respect for Michael's artistic gift. The two of them never collaborated, but you recall back in the day, who you with, Michael or Prince? Who you got, Michael or Prince? Prince or Michael? I think some of you know the story, may know the story, maybe you haven't heard it, of the one time that they almost collaborated, got this close. So on Michael's song, Bad, you remember the video that came out later, Wesley Snipes played the other character in the video. So Quincy Jones had convinced Michael that if you and Prince are ever going to do anything together, this is the song. Y'all got to come together on this Bad song. So Prince invites Michael, Q invites Michael and Prince to his house to talk about it one night. A few minutes before they're supposed to get together for dinner, Q's phone rings at the house. Q, it's Michael. Hey, Michael. Is Prince there yet? Q said no. He says, okay, click. 2 minutes later, the phone rings. Q, it's Prince. Is Michael there yet? No, he's not. Okay, click. These two Negroes are riding around the neighborhood. Because nobody won't go in the house and wait on the other. So Michael calls back, and Q says, Michael, just come to the house, man. Stop all this. So Michael pulls up, gets out, comes in the house. 2 seconds later, Prince pulls up. Prince comes in. So they're sitting down, about to have a conversation, about to have some dinner, and Prince says, I have one question about the lyrics you guys sent me for the song. Q said, sure, Prince. He said, whose line is this right here? Q looked, he said, what line? He said, this line right here. He said, whose line is this? And Q said, well, that's Michael's line. And Prince said, well, thank you for having me. God bless you. Good night. And he dipped. He left. And the line was, your butt is mine. Your butt is mine. So in the video where they're contesting, Prince is going to say, Michael is going to say to Prince, your butt is mine. And Prince told me, he says, no, my butt is mine. And he could not fathom Michael saying to him, your butt is mine. And the collaboration that almost was never happened. And I've asked Q, we've been friends for years, we've traveled the world together. I've teased Q so many times. I said, why couldn't y'all just change the line? I mean, the world missed out on a Michael Prince collaboration because nobody thought to just change the lyric. I mean, that could have been done, right? And he just laughs, and I never got a straight answer about why nobody thought to change the lyric, but the collaboration that almost was never was. But the world has lost two artistic geniuses whose songs, again, are on the soundtrack to many of our lives. And I don't know what I will get around to writing about, if I will, about my 20-year friendship with Prince, because Michael I met just a couple of times. I said to somebody earlier today that it would be cosmically unfair for me to have been good friends with both of them, although I would have loved that. That's just being greedy to be friends with both of them. Michael I met a few times, but at least with Prince I got to have a 20-year friendship that I will treasure for the rest of my life. So the Michael Jackson story, back to Michael, is a story of someone who I think in time we will come to appreciate in a different way. But I just believe in celebrating genius wherever I find it. It's what I love about being on PBS and love about being on public radio. I get a chance to talk to people whose lives, whose legacies, whose work, and whose witness have left an imprint on our lives, and that fascinates me. And so it might seem at first glance that the Michael Jackson story of these last 16 weeks of his life is a bit out of my wheelhouse, but I think once you get into it and start reading it, you'll see that the same treatment that I gave the King book is the same treatment I gave the Michael story, which is trying to figure out what it's like when a human being, a fellow human being, is trying to get his or her life together and what that drama is all about. It fascinates me. And there you have the story of Before You Judge Me. And I thank you for listening and for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was broadcaster, author, and publisher Tavis Smiley, whose new book is Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.